Okay, Tov.
Let's learn weiter. Okay, so we've reached an extremely meaningful part of Lonely Man of Faith, even though the whole book is meaningful, but over here especially it deals with an issue that's on all of our minds and hearts all the time, and it's on all thinking Jews' minds and hearts, and that's the concept of the need to crystallize feelings and experiences of prayer into standardized texts. Right? Zogin the Werther, saying the words, flipping pages, saying the words, back and forth, right? And as all Jews that are thinking Jews and feeling Jews very often get frustrated by the need for this. And the Rav over here in Lonely Men of Faith, where he is at this point of the book speaking about the covenantal community. And therefore he's explaining that prayer, like prophecy, what's the main focus of prayer and prophecy? The God-man dialogue, knowing that you're actually talking to God. And even ecstatic adoration, singing a beautiful, inspired song at a sunset, is not talking to God, right? Psuke de Zimra, which is the ecstatic adoration of God's beauty, is not talking to God. Singing beautiful love songs is not talking to your beloved. It's singing about your beloved. And therefore, if you sing songs about God, you sing songs, you know, to God, and you praise Him and you request and everything, all those are the technicalities of prayer, but not prayer itself. Prayer itself is Dalef Niyamiyat Ha'imid, standing before God. That is the act of prayer. And therefore the question is, as any thinking Jew is always troubled by, that sometimes the words seem to get in the way. Sometimes the pages and pages and pages seem to get into the way, not only don't facilitate, but seem to sometimes... Shter, Vizakman, the opposite of facilitating.
Obstruct
one's ability to have a real, intentional, meaningful relationship with God, because you have to go through the formalities, and that's what the Rav is dealing with over here. So let's read inside. We began this already last week, and we even began last week the Halachic Man, where here what the Rav hints to, and Halachic Man he elaborates on. So let's read again over here on page 54 by us. Let's just start from the sentence that says, the beginning of page 54, we can start with the last words on page 53. Everyone remembers where we are, yeah? We're at the number one where he says the threefold reasons. Everyone have their page? I'm just going to start. It's in the middle of the paragraph we're up to. Prayer is basically an awareness of man finding himself in the presence of. That's where we're starting from. Prayer is basically an awareness of man, yeah? Everyone have it? Mm-hmm. Prayer is basically an awareness of man finding himself in the presence of and addressing himself to his Maker. And to pray has one connotation, only to stand before God. To the extent that we learned in the footnote last week, that that's why in prayer we don't mention God being King of the world. Because that's not the point of prayer, it's just you and God. To be sure, this awareness has been objectified and crystallized in standardized definitive text whose recitation is obligatory. You have to say the words. You have to turn those pages. By the way, I forgot to mention last week, a friend of mine once said that it's only a frum Jew could understand the tainug that there is when, like, it's a day that you know you don't have to say tachnun. Right? It's like you're saying like 40 pages anyway, but you don't have to say tachnun. Oh, you have this like geschmack inside. Right, and only a frum Jew could understand. Like, what did you gain exactly? What's this feeling? Out of 43 pages, you only have to say 41, right? But you have that geschmack there. You don't have to say those pages over there. I don't know if I ever told you, but I have to say, because it's, first of all, it tells who he was, but it's also, you know, sometimes it's good to know that frum people all feel the same thing. Shlomo Freifeld Zatzal from Shur Yashuv, yeah? Everyone heard of Shlomo Freifeld, the one that started Shur Yashuv. Shlomo Freifeld was a geschmack Jew. Like, he was a really geschmack Jew. They say he was a Talmud of Rav Huttner. And they say that Rav Huttner had such a big mind that he could understand the hearts of the American Jewish youth. And Reb Shlomo had such a big heart that he could understand the minds of American Jewish youth. Anyway, Reb Shlomo Freifeld said that if you want to have a taste of what's Olam Haba, like you want to have a little taste once in a while, what is Gan Eden feel like? A taste. So he said like this, you go to a wedding. You know, you go to a wedding. And it's not the wedding of, like, you know, a neighbor that you just sit and have a steak and, you know, do a little, you know, one or two rounds by the dancing. But, like, a wedding of, like, your best friend, your brother, you know, a wedding where you dance like a chaza, like you schwitz and like a ferd, you know, you get all verschwitzed and whatever, you're all disgusting and you come back from the wedding, you're exhausted and your bones are aching and you're verschwitzed and you can't wait to go into the shower. And you go into the shower and you could barely stand up because you're so tired. You go into a good hot shower and whatever, and you get into your pajamas. And you can't wait. You're like, you know, you're already getting into your bed and you're lying into your bed and you get under the covers. And oh my God, you remembered you didn't daven Maariv yet. Oh my God, you remembered you have to daven. You're already lying in bed. You have to daven Maariv. You're already lying in bed. And you're about to, and all of a sudden you remember that you did daven Maariv. That's what Gan Eden feels like. That moment where you remember that you did daven Maariv. Oh, yeah, I taka did. Right before the smorgasbord, I chap the Maariv. Oh, and then you close your eyes. That little, that moment is like a taste of what Gan Eden feels like. That's what Shlomo Freifeld said. So anyway, so we have all these texts, these pages and pages and pages, right? And the recitation is obligatory. So the Rav says that even though prayer seemingly is being the presence of God, we have these texts. Why do we have these texts? Says the Rav. The total faith commitment. Again, if it is a commitment, that's the word. The total faith commitment. Commitment means that I'm objectifying, I'm becoming objective. The total faith commitment tends always to transcend the frontiers of fleeting amorphous subjectivity and to venture into the outside world of the well-formed objective gesture. It has to become an objective gesture. And the question, of course, that we asked over here is a big, fat, neon red flashing light question. Why? Why? Why does this faith commitment have to be transformed into a well-formed objective gesture? Why? And then the Rav goes on to say over here, he says, but no matter how important this tendency of the faith commitment is, but Lamaisa, that's not prayer. Prayer is standing before God. So here the Rav like sort of just hints to it. He doesn't really explain. He just says that if it's a total faith commitment, it has to be objectified into crystallized texts and stuff. But he doesn't explain why. He just says that it tends to. That's what has to happen. But why? Ribbono shel Olam, why? Why does it have to be transferred into these pages and pages that Orthodox Jews always say? Oh. So the first place he answers this, that we need to talk about, the place where the Rav really explains is in Halachic Man. So let's stop open up Halachic Man to page 57.
Didn't you say last time because a subjective religion cannot endure? That was...
That's in Halachic Man.
Right, so but that... Okay.
We're going to talk about that. That's where we began reading it. That's in Halachic Man. Mm-hmm. Page 57. You want to look on with me? Okay. Page 57, the bottom paragraph. L'chaim, l'chaim. Okay. Everyone sees the bottom of 57? A subjective religiosity cannot endure. And all those tendencies to transform the religious act into pure subjectivity, meaning what does it mean to transform all those tendencies that they want, or what's a religious act that it's pure subjectivity, based on how I feel God? In other words, in very simple English, if let's say, you ready? Let's say you say, you know, prayer is feeling God. I'm going to ask you, how often when you daven three times a day, how often do you feel God? Don't feel like you have to answer.
Thank you.
We could probably say probably most of the times we daven, we don't, right? But let's say the Rebbe is saying, let's say I would say prayer is feeling God. So as anyone that ever has a routine knows, if you don't have a routine that's set, what happens after a while? Say, yeah, I'm going to learn Daf Yomi. How many times a person makes, you know, a good resolution and it lasts for exactly 4 days, right? Why? Because if you don't have a routine, it can endure. If I would say to prayer means feeling God, and it's in the middle of the day, you have your boss yelled at you, you have a million things that need to get done, you know, your car is giving problems. You know when you have those days when, like, everything goes wrong, like one of these Murphy Law days? Like, with just like Murphy Law, this day is like a perfect example. And now I tell you, get up and feel God. It ain't happening. There's no chance that it's going to happen. Just not. So if a relationship with God is always based on my subjective feelings, that can't endure. There won't be a commitment to it. It won't be continued. Let's see inside. All those tendencies to transform the religious act into pure subjectivity negate all corporeality and all sensation in religious life. So those times that you even are able to come into that place, you're negating your life and admit man into a pure and abstract world where there is no either eating nor drinking. But religious individuals sitting with their crowns on their heads. What's the Rav making reference to? Where are these words coming? Eating and drinking with their crowns on their heads.
Last week's parsha. Could be.
That right, that's true, that last week's parasha about eating and drinking God, right? But this specifically where it says eating and drinking, where there's neither eating nor drinking, but sitting with crowns on their head.
That's Olam Haba.
Olam Haba. That's the language Chazal use when they speak of Olam Haba. They say, Ein lo yachila v'lo yishtia, ala tzadikim yoshim v'atrasem b'Hashem. He's making a play on words. When Chazal explain Olam Haba, they say, there's no eating or drinking, but rather the crowns of the Shechina on their head. Right? Which, by the way, of course, Chassidus, at least, Chassidus says that's Gan Eden, not Mashiach. I don't want to get off topic, but everyone should just know. I always like to point this out. According to Hasidic teachings, Gan Eden, which is, you know, which is where the souls sit until the resurrection, that's what Chazal mean at that point when they say there's no eating or drinking, just the crowns of the Shechina on their head. When Mashiach comes after the resurrection, then we're going to be in the physical world again for all eternity. Just parenthetically. But I know it's a machlekes, but I'm it is a machlekes Rambam and Ramban. It's machlekes Rambam and Ramban. That's true. The Rambam says Gan Eden is eternity. Ramban, Nachmanides, and Kabbal and Chassidus all say that this physical world is the eternal state. Anyway, but that's what the Rav is making a play on words. He's saying that the spiritual experience is no eating or drinking or crowns on the head, rather, right? Now, but anyone that ever had a real spiritual experience that the Rav is referring to knows that that can't endure.
It's not supposed to endure.
Right. That's the point of it being a spiritual experience, right? It's a peak experience.
Right. Which leads to the question, the minute you objectify something, it loses its meaning.
So that's what he's speaking about. But right now he's speaking about the fact, we're going to get to that in a second, but right now we're speaking about the fact that a subjective experience, that emotional experience of not eating, not drinking, being a spiritual high, that can't endure. If anyone's been to, you know, any type of event, you know, imagine wherever you go, you know, what makes you feel the most spiritual. Think of the place, for some people, it's the Kotel, for some people, have, you know, whatever place you go that makes you feel most spiritual, right? Imagine what would happen if you'd go there every single day. Everyone knows it won't be the same anymore. There's a story, actually, they say that there was a Jew... Gutnik, his father, the millionaire's father, I forgot his first name, Rabbi Gutnik. The Gutnik everyone knows is the one that, you know, that owns the hockey team, whatever, the wealthy one from Australia. So his father, old Rabbi Gutnik, so they're Kohanim. Now, you know, from 1951 until 1970, after the Rebbe Rayatz, the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, passed away, so those years, 1951 to 1970, when the Rayatz's wife was still alive, so the Rebbe and his wife would eat all the Yontav meals upstairs in 770 where the Rayatz used to live, on the second floor, with his wife, with the Rayatz's Rebbetzin. And the old Hasidim would eat with him, by the Seder, by the Yontav meals, the Rebbe would have the Seder with the older Chassidim and his brother-in-law and the older Chassidim. So there are a lot of interesting stories from those meals, there are whole books written of the discussions, fascinating. It's like people are just sitting and having a meal with the Rebbe, with the Lubavitch Rebbe. But there's one time that, there's a story that this Rabbi Gutnik, the first time he ate there, so he was invited up to eat a Yontav meal, and they put him to sit right next to the Rebbe. Now, I don't know if, I'm sure some of you have had experiences with people that were like big tzaddikim. Right? Imagine you had to sit next to them and eat a meal. He didn't know what to do with himself. He was sitting next to the Rebbe, and they put a piece of chicken, you know, and for a piece of gefilte fish, and he felt mamish. He was sitting next to the Rebbe, he was used to being by a Verbrengen, and look, here he's sitting next to the Rebbe, they put him, so he didn't know what to do. So he asked the Rebbe, this is what he said. He said to the Rebbe, he said, Rebbe, ich kann fragen, I want to ask a question. Ich bin doch a Kohen. I'm a Kohen. Now it says that in the Beis HaMikdash, the Kohanim would eat the meat, right? A Kohanim oichlim v'bayla miskaprim. The atonement came, the Kohanim would actually eat the meat of the Korbanos. So he said to the Rebbe, how are Kohanim able to stand in the Beis HaMikdash, not the Kotel, the Beis HaMikdash where God's presence was there, and have flesh, like we just said, right? To have a good steak. You had a good... How could you eat a steak, you know, fresh and a steak in the Beis HaMikdash? So the Rebbe smiled because he understood why Gutnik was asking it, right? He understood that was the real meaning of the question. So the Rebbe smiled at him and responded, they got used to it. you get used, after a while, you know, you get used to it. You get used to it. And I actually remember, and the height of this, I always think about this, that when people say, you know, oh, if only I could be by the Kotel, if only I could have a spirit, if only, all the if onlys, if I could do this, then I would feel God. Right? If only I could do these things, I would feel God. So I always like to say the Gemara in Soita. I think it's Daf Zayin or Zayin Ches, something like that. There's a Gemara in Soita. So you all know the halacha that a man that wants to bring his wife to drink the Soita waters, right? The bitter waters. So the halacha is that if she, when she's going with her husband up to Yerushalayim, if she has relations again, then the water doesn't check her. So the Gemara asks, one second, how could she have relations again? She's with her husband. So the Gemara says that, and with them there would also be witnesses that would go with them. So the Gemara says that she had relations with the I don't remember the exact shak v'tar, but basically it says she had relations in the Beis HaMikdash with the Pirchei Kohuna. She was Mezana in the Beis HaMikdash with the Pirchei Kohuna, the young Kohanim. That's the Gemara's answer. And I remember when I learned the first time, like, I'm in Shtal Zechfor, in the Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara says it says Amatzias. But the answer is, when you're in a place that you're used to, you don't feel it anymore, right? So that's what the Rav is saying over here, that if it's based on, you know, a subjective experience, any subjective experience that one could have eventually goes away. It's not going to remain. Anything that's based on subjective experience can't endure. Let's read further. All those tendencies to transform the religious act into pure subjectivity, negate all corporeality and all sensation in religious life, and admit men into a pure and abstract world, which that can't endure, where there's neither eating nor drinking, but religious individuals sitting with their crowns on their heads and enjoying their own inner experiences, their own tempestuous, heaven-storming spirits, right? It's interesting, the Rav is like making fun that the subjective people, what are you essentially having a pleasure from when you're having a subjective experience? Yourself, the Rav is saying. It's really coming that it's based on yourself. It's your own heaven-storming spirit, their own hidden longings and mysterious yearnings will in the end prove null and void. The psychic power of religion, psychic means like solid, like forceful. The psychic power of religion that seizes hold of man, that subjects and dominates him, is in force only when the religion is a concrete religion, a religion of the life of the senses, in which there is sight, smell, and touch. A religion which a man of flesh and blood can feel with all of his senses, soon as an organs, with his entire being. What is he saying here? What's he saying here, thereof? What do you think he's saying? Why does it have to be objectified? Why could subjective in religion can't endure? Only religion that what? When can religion dominate a person?
You have to feel it. You have to actually... You know,
what does he mean, feel it here?
Physically, like you have to shake Lubinus, or you have to put the tefillin on your arm. You have to... What are the other, like, real...
We could, well, we could summarize, or say the words, go through the pages, go through the motions. In other words, that there's something black and white. There are the things, there's the routine. The routine that we're so often, we kvetcha gibbons going against rote, but the Rav is saying that rote is what endures. Anyone that, I don't know, people's experiences that you've had, but the worst thing about tshuva could do is get married within 3 or 4 years after they got frum. Worst thing they could possibly do. You know why? Because the first 2-3 years when I don't know how many of you, if you're a Bali Tshuva or you had, we had experiences where you got closer to God. In the beginning, about Tshuvas in Disney World. Right? And there are a lot of stories about Tshuvas that got married a couple of years after they got from, 2-3 years after they got from. And then, as anyone knows, a Bali Tshuva after 3-4 years has the same gedder of an FFB. Right? And all of a sudden, it's boring all of a sudden. And all those tempestuous soul yearning experiences go away because they can't endure. It's impossible. People are human beings. And we have mood swings and we have to pay the mortgage and we have things we have to go through. We can't have a subjective thing. And people got married in that state and then they didn't want to maintain it anymore. Now, I'm not saying everybody. People always change. People always change. And people, and we've spoken a lot about the fact that that's a good thing. But the idea of religion is that there's an essential commitment, the Rav is saying, a religion of the life of the senses, touch, smell, that's something very basic that we know that come hell or high water, I'm going to daven mincha. I might not feel anything, I might whatever, it's going to be a dry mincha, but a mincha is going to happen.
And that's good?
It's not good if it remains that, but it's unbelievable that it, at least that's always there. That's what the Rav is saying. It's not good if it remains that,
right?
But it's unbelievable that that remains the skeleton that's always there.
I'm not in a position to argue with the Rav about anything, but the religion could have developed into a scheduled
sessions of davening, chakras, you know, mincha, marav, but less focus on the structured words that we use today that have so little meaning to us today. They could have had, we all get together for half an hour in the morning and meditate.
Right, so, and I'm telling you, show me a religion that has that. People,
we're not any other. We're not the same.
But that's other but that's what I'm saying to you. That all other religions that have, let's say, Buddhism, whatever, they have these meditations. They're also going to be in segments, a couple of days, a couple of weeks. It's impossible to tell someone that every day of your life, living, going to Wall Street, living a business, the world, which Judaism is about. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to say to you that no matter where you are, what day it is, meditate three times a day. It just can't happen. Now, one second. Wait a second. What can happen is low-grade meditation, which we're going to get to today. There's a basic type of meditation, which we're going to get to today. So it depends what you mean with the word meditation, but there's a low-grade awareness of God, not meditation per se, but an awareness of God, or at least a basic meditative thing that is obligatory, and that the Rav is going to say. Okay. So that, in other words, The fact that people don't think at all about God, that's also not what's supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. But to have a religion that has three times a day to meditate, it can't be. It's impossible.
But there is a religion that survived that did not have this objectification of prayer.
Which one?
Judaism. Biblical Judaism, until it was taken over by Rabbinic Judaism,
okay,
did not have this objectification of prayer or of ritual. We had the Beis HaMikdash, which basically removed the individual from this objectification.
Two answers. First of all, you know that according to the tradition, they prayed three times a day even when there was a Beis HaMikdash. That's ready from the forefathers, from the patriarchs.
And I beg to differ. But the Gemara
brings two shittas.
The text.
No, the concept, tiknun, you know, avos tiknun, is the concept of prayer in morning, afternoon, and night. It's not that they made shachris mincha de amida.
No, the text they didn't make. But the concept of praying three times a day was there already.
But was that meditation? So
what they didn't have until much later, until Rabbinic Judaism, quote unquote, were the texts, right? Mm-hmm. So the answer that's given by many, many commentators, and I'm sure Jay will tell me the other ones, but the answer that's given by many commentators, especially in Chassidus, is that, I'll tell you like this, Lenny, how come you don't need to meditate that I exist? Exactly. So in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, they didn't need a Psukei Dezimra. They didn't need to speak about Srafim and Eifanim. They didn't need to go through Kaddish, Kaddish, Kaddish. They didn't need the blessings of the Shema. They spoke to God because they saw godliness. They saw Him in a very palpable way. And in Biblical Judaism, there's a great book, which I highly recommend. You ever read Lights of Prophecy by Bezalel Na'or? You read it?
Yeah.
Great book. Excuse me. It's essentially a translation of from Rav Kook. Bezalel Na'or is the greatest translator, Yakadov Shulman also, but Bezalel Na'or is the best translator of Rav Kook's writings, and he has a book called Lights of Prophecy, which is very small. It's like 30 pages. Rabbi Weinberger, many years, like I think 22 years ago, went through the whole thing in a Shavuos night. It's a beautiful book. And essentially what Rav Kook explains over there, based on the Alter Rebbe, is that why did Anshe Knesset Gedola find the need to destroy the Yetzer of Avodah Zarah? We all know the Gemara in Yuma that says that the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshe Knesset Gedola, they destroyed the Yetzer of Avodah Zarah. When we read Tanakh, we think they're absolutely out of their minds, right? That they're bound down, whatever.
My question is, could they destroy other Yetzer?
They did.
What about others,
they did. They did. The Gemara says that they did. The Gemara says they completely destroyed the Yetzirah, and then the whole, they went through the whole land of Israel, no chickens laid their eggs, and there was no procreating. Because there was no desire to procreate anymore, to be fruitful and multiply, right? So therefore they realized that Yetzirah's got to come back, right? Because Freud has to have a parnasa, and also because the world needs to continue, right? So, but the Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah, that remained destroyed. Right, so Rav Kook, so the Alter Rebbe explains in the Kutei Torah, Rav Kook explains at great length what's the deeper meaning why they had to destroy the Yetzer of Avodah Zarah. So the explanation is because in this world there has to be an equilibrium between good and evil. There has to be the possibility of two paths, equal paths. It's impossible. God does not give a challenge that can't be kept, and it's impossible for there not to be equal access to both, which is why I always say the best example is the internet. There was never such a possibility to get filth, never. Today, like I always say, you know, you could do all 365 prohibitions on your cell phone, right? You could do any avera you want, you could do with your cell phone. In the old days, they used to have to plan when they wanted to do a sin. 100 years ago, they had to like buy a ticket to the city. There was like a whole process. On the other hand, the internet makes nobody could ever say that they can't learn Torah. There's no excuse to say, oh, I don't know how to learn Gemara. You could put in 10 seconds, you could have a shiur on any page of Gemara in any language. On any book, almost every book there is in every language. So there has to be an equilibrium in the world. Access to Kedusha and Tumah has to be equal. That's the rule of the world. And therefore, the Alter Rebbe and Rav Kook explains in Lights of Prophecy, they explain that as long as there was prophecy, though, in Biblical Judaism, what Jay is calling it, Biblical Judaism was a time where there was the light of God, spirituality. It's not just today where you have like a spiritual fuzzy feeling. The light of God was openly apparent in the world. They would actually have visions of the divine, whatever that means. They would actually, the Kohen Gadol would say God's name and they would prostrate themselves on the floor, get down on the floor and bow down. They would hear the name of God. They would hear the Shekhinah coming out of his mouth. There were these visions. I mean, that's not in Chassidus, that's in Chazal. There were 10 miracles every day in the Beis HaMikdash. And so therefore, it was like when Lenny doesn't have to meditate to talk to me because he sees me. So they didn't need in Biblical Judaism, quote unquote, when God's light was there. So let me, one thing, before I get back to it. So prophecy was around. And therefore, since prophecy was around, there was so seemingly, how was there free choice? How could a person ever do an Aveira if prophecy is around? So that's why there had to be the Yetzer of Avodah Zarah. You know what the Yetzer of Avodah Zarah is, essentially? This will be able to relate to it. I once saw a beautiful medrash. I don't usually like to, advertise my own classes, but it happens to be one of my favorite classes because it's a beautiful idea that for years bothered me. I have online in Torah Cafe a class called The Mystery of the Cherubs, the whole thing about the Kruvim. What's the idea of the Kruvim? And essentially I found a medrash which is unbelievable in Torah Shlema. The medrash says that really the Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah and the Yetzirah for Gilui Arayos is the same Yetzirah, two sides of the same coin. And that's why the Kruvim was the counter to both. The Kruvim, you know, the Gemara says that the Babylonians, when the Kruvim were taken out, they were laughing at us that we're Avodah Zarah. Judaism, the most monotheistic religion in the world, has the Kruvim in there. And what were the Kruvim? What were they a statue of? A man and a woman in intimate embrace. So it's like the ultimate Yetzirah of Avodah Zarah and Gilui Arayos as a statue in the Holy of Holies, right? Because essentially, both Yetzirah of Avodah Zarah and Gilui Arayos is essentially the tainug of the soul of being unified with God gone wrong. Both of them. What's the tainug of Gilui Arayos? You want that intimacy? That's what your soul had with God and is supposed to have with God now. But when that feeling of that desire for Gilui Arayos, for sexuality, that is essentially what the soul experiences with God, gone wrong. Same thing with Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah was feeling the divine in objects. We don't see that because we don't see the divinity in objects. But there is divinity in objects. Now, that divinity is connected with the one God. But back then, the type was instead of going up to infinity to connect to the godliness in objects, and to connect to feel the divine within things. So it's the same as the sexual drive. We don't understand this because we don't have that spiritual perception. But it was that same drive to feel intimate with God in physical objects. That's what Avodah Zarah comes from, essentially. So says the Alter Rebbe, and Rav Kook explains in Light of Prophecy. So as long as that feeling of God was around, so what was the Yetzer for that Avodah Zarah? To feel God, to feel that divine and physical object. But they say, but once prophecy went away, Biblical Judaism stopped, so to speak. God wasn't talking to prophets anymore. We weren't experiencing the divine anymore. And don't forget, when we speak about prophecy, prophecy did not just mean those that were written in Tanakh, right? You all know that. The Gemara in Megillah says there are 48 prophets written in Tanakh. But how many prophets were there in the Jewish people? Remember the Gemara in Megillah? The Gemara in Megillah says there were 48 prophets and prophetesses are the ones that are actually written in Tanakh. But how many Jews had prophecy? 1,200,000. Kiflaim the double of Yetzim Mitzrayim. And there, those are those that had full-fledged prophecy. It's just that it wasn't written down because it wasn't, quote-unquote, necessary for the survival of Jewish people. But those, that's the amount, 1,200,000, those that had full-fledged prophecy. But even those that never had full-fledged prophecy had a very deep feeling of the divine. They might not have had, God didn't essentially give them a message, maybe, but they had visions of the divine. And therefore, if Cook says, you had the Yetzirah of Avodah Zarah to counter that, to have that equilibrium in the world. But when in the Second Temple, the men of the Great Assembly saw prophecy stopped, who were the last prophets? When did prophecy stop? Chagai Zechariah Malachi, which was the beginning of the Second Temple era. The men of the Great Assembly were the last prophets. Those are the ones we're going to see soon. The Rav is going to speak about them. Those are the ones that instituted prayer because prophecy was stopping. So when they saw that equilibrium wasn't there, that's why they stopped the Yetzirah of Avodah Zarah. And that's why, to answer Jay's question, how he got into this, biblical Judaism times when prophecy was there, when they had these experiences of the divine, they didn't need the objectified prayer. After prophecy stopped, rabbinic Judaism didn't just begin because there were a bunch of evil, nasty, arrogant rabbis that decided they want a parnasa. There were the tzaddikim, the Anshe Knesset Gedolah, they saw, as the Rav is going to say in another page, that prophecy was stopping, that the divine was not as rampant, and therefore that's what the Rav is saying, they needed to objectify religion into these texts. Agav, that's what Rav Kook continues to try. This is the Alter Rebbe, but doesn't say this. The Rav Kook says, that's why now, as Mashiach is coming closer, and we're about to have prophecy again in the world, that's why now Rav Kook says that one has to even more go back to that place of trying to meditate. In other words, even more than 100, 200 years ago, we have to start focusing that again. But anyway, but that's the answer why biblical Judaism functioned without standardized texts. They didn't need those texts because they experienced the divine in an open way. So that's our emunah, that the standardized religion, and all of our religion, everyone knows all of our religion is from Anshe Knesset Gedolah, right? Rabbinic Judaism began with the men in the Great Assembly, everything. Almost. I mean, you had mitzvahs, tzitzis, and everything else, but the religion we know is from Anshe Knesset Gedolah. And it's not by accident that started then when prophecy finished, because that was the transition when they saw that the godliness was no longer felt, and therefore that's what the Rebbe is saying, that now we needed the halacha to objectify God. Because it's impossible to meditate every day. Impossible. Just can't happen. Especially mincha. In the middle of the day, imagine.
Is meditation the same as a mystical, when we talked about before, the mystical union, or like can't be the same as prayer? Meditation, because he said before that prayer is not the mystical union.
It's very important, again, I mentioned this quickly before, but we're going to speak about it more. It's very important when we speak about meditation to define what that means. Mm-hmm. Because there's a type of meditation which is prayer. And that's what the Rav is going to say. So what the Rav is going to say is that there is a type of meditation, let's just say it clearly, the meditation that you're in God's presence. That's it. That meditation that you're in God's presence, that, and I don't call it meditation, the word for it in English is awareness. It's not meditation, it's awareness. And there's a big difference. People confuse the two. There's an awareness of presence. Awareness of presence. Awareness of presence, the Rav is going to say, is prayer.
So what's a subjective religiosity?
The meditations. Deeper meditations. Not just a general awareness of God's presence. An actual meditation on God. Meditative states of being close to Him. Meditations of what one is supposed to once in a while try to have by davening that also. Not just a general awareness of God's presence, but an awareness of Him. Levels of His light. Ways He reveals Himself. The different levels of meditation.
But there is an awareness of God within this subjective religiosity, or does it turn?
It's Bechal Masai Mona. Within this subjective religiosity, of course, awareness of God, but more than just a general awareness. We're going to talk about, when we get back into the Holy Man of Faith, Reuven, you'll see what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Two questions. One.
We're going to get to the Reb Chaim, hopefully, today, Anna.
So, davening is an awareness of Hashem.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why the real davening is when you say Baruch Atah, because you're discussing with Him and you're using an informal way. So, but then, if you don't know what you're saying, or if you're saying the Akdamas and you're like, I have no idea what this is about, you're not davening.
Let's get to that. Like I just said, we're going to see the Holy Man of Faith in another couple of minutes, okay?
And then my second question is, a subjective religion cannot endure, and we know that the Rav is very familiar with all of these Protestant thinkers, Kierkegaard, all these others, and my understanding,
He's going to get to that in a second.
Let's get
to that in a second. Let's read further inside. Page 58 in Halachic Man. Again. it's a long run-on sentence, but we're five lines up, page 58, yeah? Only a religion that with their sight, smell, and touch, a religion which a man of flesh and blood can feel with all of his senses and organs, with his entire being, a sensuous religion which cognitive man will encounter in a very palpable way wherever he may go. Only that can endure. A subjective religiosity comprised of spiritual moods, of emotions and affections, of outlooks and desires will never be blessed with success. Let's skip to page 59. Third line from the top. The halacha which was given to us from Sinai is the objectification of religion in clear and determinate forms, in precise and authoritative laws, and in definite principles. That's what halacha is, the objectification of your relationship with God. It translates subjectivity into objectivity, the amorphous flow of religious experience, into a fixed pattern of lawfulness. To what may this matter be compared? To the physicist who transforms light and sound. He quotes from Chaim Nachum Bialik. If you're looking at footnote 73, Reuven, it's fascinating, actually, that he quotes from Chaim Nachum Bialik in the Halacha Nagoda, which is very interesting that the Rav brings from Bialik to explain the meaning of Halacha. But that is what Bialik explains in that essay. That, you know, of course, Bialik was troubled with the Halacha, as many people were, but that's, even Bialik says that that's the point of Halacha. That's what he's quoting from. To what may this be compared? To the physicist who transforms light and sound and all of the contents of our qualitative perceptions into quantitative relationships. Right? What's a physicist? A physicist will explain to you in terms what the philosophers were breaking their heads for centuries. Right? Philosophers were breaking their heads for centuries. What happens when you see something? Right? Spinoza, Descartes, they all. What happens when you see something? Is it perception? Berkeley, right? Is it real? But what is physics going to say? He's going to start giving you cheshbainus. He's going to start explaining to you light and mises and formulas and geschäften. He could explain to you what happens when you touch something, right? So what did they essentially do? They're objectifying everything we experience into quantitative relationships, mathematical functions, and objective fields of force. In the same manner as philosophical schools accepted the position of Plato and Aristotle that existence means fixity, regularity, and orderliness, right? Plato and Aristotle loved orderliness, right? That's why Plato, there was a sign over Plato's academy that he who has not learned mathematics shall not enter here. They loved orderliness, right? We spoke about Aristotle and everything also. So the halacha declares that any religiosity which does not lead to determinate actions, firm and clear-cut measures, chiseled and delimited laws and statutes will provide sterile. It's a funny word he says over here, sterile. You know what sterile means, right?
Won't bear fruit.
Right, exactly. In other words, a person that could go on a retreat, a meditation retreat, and lamaisa. Are you going to... Huh? Tachlis. You're going to learn about Metzir or not? Right? You're going to learn about, you know, you go to a concert, one of these concerts that are very inspiring and everything. Tachlis, you're going to open up above Metzir or not? You're going to put on tefillin or not? That has to be tachlis. Otherwise, it's just this experience, which is wonderful, but doesn't endure. And I mentioned to you before when I wasn't being recorded that it can be compared to, you know, having fun but not bearing fruit, etc. If you remember, you remember. The concept of non-being or of heilic matter also exists in the world of religion. Experience has shown, now this is what Yaakov mentioned before, experience has shown that the whole religious ideology, which bases itself on the objective nature of religion, from Schleiermacher and Kierkegaard to Natorp, can have dangerous, destructive consequences that far outweigh any putative gains. Now, I don't want to get off topic, but I highly disagree with what the Rav is saying over here. First of all, Schleiermacher and Kierkegaard, I'm a chassid of both of theirs. I mean, they're two of my favorite people in the whole world, and I don't agree that they brought to dangerous consequences. I don't know what the Rav is talking about. I don't know Natorp, but I don't know him at all. But Schleiermacher and Kierkegaard were all about having subjectivity along with objectivity. They weren't saying to do away with whatever. There is such a thing. Essentially, by saying that Schleiermacher and Kierkegaard was destructive is the exact same thing that the Vilna Gaon said about chassidus. That Hasidism came and focused on the subjective, and what was the Vilna Gaon afraid of? Antinomian tendencies that will do away with halacha. Great, but that never happened. Never happened.
Because of the
grow. No, I don't think that's true.
Today's chassidim are chassidei grah, maybe.
What do you mean?
He steered them.
I don't think that's true. I don't think I'm not one. I know that there's a.
The, I know it's hard to hear.
No, I said this. I don't think it's true. I know the Misnagdim love saying that if it wasn't for the girl, the Chassidim would go off the Derech. I don't think that that's true. If anyone learns the works of Chassidus, especially the Alter Rebbe's works, that's so into halacha, halacha, halacha.
The Alter Rebbe was might have been a yachin.
I want to tell you something, by the way. I see Jay has over here that book, Makor Baruch. You know who wrote the Makor Baruch?
Sure.
Baruch Epstein. So Baruch Epstein, of course, anyone that doesn't know, was the Torah Tamima.
My uncle did it.
He was the son of the of the Aruch HaShulchan. And Chassidim used to, you could apply to Baruch Epstein the phrase that Chassidim used to say, Ktsas Mu'beres. You know what Ktsas Mu'beres means?
Yeah.
Little pregnant, like the daughter that comes home to her father and says, Dad, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is that I'm pregnant. The good news, I'm only a little pregnant. Right? So Ktsas Mu'beres is what Chassidim used to say about people that would be a little maskilim. Like they'd be a little maskil. Not like a mamshapi karis, but only Ktsas Mu'beres, only a little maskil. So Baruch Epstein was one of those. So he's the source. I'm sure many of you, I don't know if this is what you're referring to, Jonathan, but I've heard a million times when I was in Lipsh Yeshivas that the Tzemach Tzedek said that if it wasn't for the Gra, the Chassidim would have gone off the Derech. The source of that is the Makor Baruch. Or Baruch Epstein wrote it down. There's no source at all from that anywhere in all of Hasidic literature. You will not find that anywhere. So I don't want to get into the whole thing. We could debate this for the whole night, but I just don't think that's true. And I think the same thing with Kierkegaard and Schleiermacher. Kierkegaard and Schleiermacher didn't go off the Derech. Kierkegaard and Schleiermacher were about in Protestantism to bring life into Bechal. The same thing with Bechal Protestantism with the Catholic Church. Protestantism began in such a way because they thought that the Catholic Church was dry religion. So there were many movements that tried to... Those movements that only focus on subjectivity can't endure. That I agree. But a movement that's about adding subjectivity to the objectified halacha, that can endure.
So, as an example, what religion did not evolve beyond subjectivity that did not survive?
Say that again one more time.
Is there a religion that did not evolve beyond the level of subjectivity that did not survive? The Rav is making a statement. If you don't go beyond subjectivity to objectivity,
right,
the religion will not survive. So there's got to be an example for that.
No, but I think that's why he said, the word that he used in Lonely Man of Faith is that... that the total faith commitment tends always to transcend the frontiers of fleeting subjectivity and to venture to that side with well from the objective gesture. In Lonely Man of Faith, he says that. It always did. All religions did that. There might have been movements.
But we see one of the world's biggest religions has lasted for 3,000 years as a totally subjective religion.
Which is that?
Buddhism.
But Buddhism also has today objectified modes of worship.
Almost
not all the Buddhists go to the ashrams and meditate. There are a lot of Buddhists that now statues of Buddha fakered over there. It's the opposite. They became the those that think that Buddhism is a vodazara. Buddhism is not a vodazara. Real Buddhism is not a vodazara.
Not at all.
Right. But today, the reason that many people associate Buddhism with a vodazara is because you have people that just go and bring little pieces of food to statues of Buddha.
That's not Buddhism.
But the Vard is that they'll tell you that they are Buddhists. And they'll tell you that this is how they're getting to their nirvana, whatever it is. Now,
rabbinic Buddhism.
It's rabbinic Buddhism, exactly. It's rabbinic Buddhism. It's now doing the halacha of bringing pieces of food to the statue of Buddha. That's how it survived. So again, I agree with you. There, like Buddhism also has those that will go to the ashrams and meditate, the monks. But for the hamonam, the pshuteam, they have their modes of worship. What they do. Yeah,
I'm still caught up in this Protestant thing, and this is maybe a bit of a tangent, but right, Protestantism is started by Martin Luther, comes up, posts the 95 Theses on the door, and says, I can't be a Catholic anymore.
This isn't really getting into a tangent. What's the about?
But he comes and he says, faith alone, and he throws everything out and says, sola scriptura and sola fide, only faith, that's all enough, you can throw out all of it. And Protestantism seems to be lasting. I believe it's doing well. They
because
fill
they become
churches.
Objectified also.
But all the halacha they don't care about. It's all about faith.
So they, but they become objectified in their gestures also.
But that objectification makes the religion stale.
Again,
that's the death knell of religion.
It doesn't have to make it stale. I agree with you.
Chassidism.
Listen to me. Chassidism came and said Judaism has become stale. Rabbinic Judaism has become stale. Let's breathe new life, right? And Hasidic movement was the most romantic, beautiful, full of vigor, life, and blah, blah, blah. Now go into a shtiebel and borrow park.
Right, exactly. That.
And it again becomes a stale. So there's always going to be this back and forth. I agree with you. It's going to... But Lamaisa, the Vart, is to always be trying to maintain both.
So why don't you just try to give up objectivism and try to live with the subjectivism?
Because that won't endure.
How do you know?
Try it, Jay.
No.
Try it.
The Rav is making a statement, and a strong statement, and saying, in absolute terms, it will not survive.
Try to find a religion that did. It can't. It's impossible. It always becomes... Fakir, the fact that you're saying that it always ends up getting stale and objectified shows you that either it turns into objectivity, or... They're not involved anymore.
I'm saying objectivism, when you take it to the next level from subjectivity and objectify the religion, automatically begins its death until it becomes stale.
Right, until another subjective movement will come to breathe a new life into it again.
So the only thing, what you're saying is, the only thing that breathes life into religion is subjectivism.
Yeah, 100%. And you have to try to add that too, but it can't just be that. It has to, again, that's why I heard recently like this. Oh, where did I just hear this? I heard a lecture on, I think it was a lecture on Rumi or something, but I heard a great mushel. The mushel of spirituality to religion is like water in a glass. The glass being a cup. The cup being religion, the water being spirituality. It's a gewaldige mushel. Why? Try to hold on to water without a cup. How much and how long can you hold on to it? But have a cup without water. That's exactly the... Religion is the cup, spirituality, subjectivity is the water.
The cup is meaningless without the water.
Correct, but without the cup, the water will slip through your hands. You're not going to be able to hold on to it. Mm-hmm. And then I chapped, after I heard this mushel, which comes from this mystic, that's exactly what Chazal meant. That same mushel says in Chazal. You all know the mushel. Tfila b'lei kavana. No? A prayer without kavana is like? Tfila b'lei kavana. A guf b'lei neshama. Right? A tefila b'lei kavana ke guf b'lei neshama. Chazal say it. A prayer without kavana is like a body without a soul. That's exactly the same word as a cup without water. Uh-huh. Body without a soul is like a cup without water. Imagine a body without a soul. What's a body without a soul? Dead. Right? But what's a soul without a body? Casper. Right? If it's a friendly ghost. Right? You can't have... That's exactly what Chazal mean. And that's what Reb Nachman Breslov said, that a misnagid is like, the difference between a chassid and a misnagid is like a cold knish and a hot knish. It's the same part, right? They have the same ingredients, but one is geschmack and hot, and one is cold and stale.
However, the main difference
is... He didn't say knish. I didn't know what word he used in Yiddish.
Kugel. The main difference is that our aim, objective, and the epitome of the religion is to be purely a soul.
What are you talking
without
about?
The goof.
That's not true.
You want to say but
what is Rambam?
That's not true.
The Rambam says that what survives and what is the essence of everyone is the soul.
Fine.
Is the intellect.
But the Rambam wouldn't say that in this world one is not supposed to refine the body. The only machlekes is the refining of the body. Is that supposed to be something that's going to remain for eternity, or is that only temporary according to the Rambam? But certainly the Rambam would say that in this world, the body is what does all the mitzvahs. One has to refine oneself. That, of course, the Rambam would agree to that.
No, but we're looking for the paradigm of existence here. That's what we're learning.
He's saying the ultimate.
The paradigm of existence is the intellectual entity of every single individual.
Right.
Which has nothing to do with the guf.
Agreed. So, well, guf, according to the Rambam.
Yeah, I'm talking about according to the Rambam.
But the Rav's talking about in this world. Though.
Yeah.
But, okay, but...
So according to the Rambam, we would say that fine, but you need the halacha to be the body as long as you're here. But lamaisa, if you don't have the body holding the soul, you don't have anything. If you don't have the cup holding the water, you can't maintain the water. But we all agree that there has to be this subjectivity. So there's always going to be these movements adding the subjectivity. Chassidus, Lahavdil, Protestantism, you know, whatever it's going to be. And then if it's not objectified, it won't remain. I tell you, like, give you an example. Shlomo Kalibach, Zecher Tzadik Levrocha, had thousands of people went through his house of love and prayer, right? What now remained of all Kalibach's efforts? Those that daven three times a day and put on tefillin without any kavanah, right? Those that became from all the people that were inspired by him and didn't go into any community can't remain. It's just we're human beings, and we can't. And as inspired as you can be, if that doesn't become objectified, it can't endure.
Why can't you have both?
Again, we keep saying you have to have both,
but we don't seem to.
So what the Rav is going to say right now, we're answering why you have to have the cup. What the Rav is going to say is that, but the Rav is saying, lonely man of faith, what he's going to say is, but prayer is the water. That's what the Rav is saying, lonely man of faith. Mm-hmm. You need the cup because it has to become objectified. You need the pages. If you don't have the pages, it can't endure. But what the Rav is now going to say, but what's prayer? The cup is the pages, is the technique of prayer, which without it, it can't endure. But what the Rav is going to say, but what is prayer? What's the water? Standing before God, the meditation. Now, which meditation? Like I answered before, Ruvain, they're not deep meditative, but it's the awareness of God, that dialogue with God, that's the water, and that has to endure. And what Mitzvah we're going to learn, we're going to start today, is what I'm going to say, based on what the Rav is saying, that we all have to know, is that that one can do three times a day.
I think our water has frozen into the cup.
So, but I'm it very often it does, uh-huh. Agreed. But so I'm saying, but the constant, and there's two responses to the water freezing into the cup. There's two responses. One is to throw the cup out altogether. And the other one is to constantly trying to keep putting it in the microwave. Mm-hmm. You have to keep putting it in the microwave. Mm-hmm. But you have to know, how do you put it in the microwave? So what the Rav is now going to say is, you can't shoot for meditative experience like that you've had when, you know, by going to the cold. You can't each time shoot for that. That's the subjectivity that can't endure. But the microwave that can endure is the basic meditation that the Rav is going to say, which is the basis of prayer, awareness of standing before God. And this, I say, and we're going to learn mitzvah from that from the Rav, this can and must happen three times a day. That before you open your mouth, the main part of prayer is at least for 5 seconds, mm-hmm. not more. Awareness that I'm standing before God. Mm-hmm. And it's the mice, it's so hard and so easy to do. Mm-hmm.
That's the subjectivity part of it.
Well, I don't know if you're going to call it subjectivity, but it's the water, it's the spirituality part. You can call it a subjectivity. You could certainly call it a part of the
subjectivity,
knowing and emotion.
Yeah, if you want to call it like that, whatever you want to call it. But it's certainly a certain, the water in the cup. At least having something that you have an awareness of God. The Dalaf Nimeat Oymet.
Or in the Rishka terminology, the kiyam of the...
That's what I was going to say from Reb Chaim, that the Maisa HaTfilin, Briska terminology, we're going to see in a few moments, the Briska terminology, that the act of prayer is not opening your mouth.
Mm-hmm. Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, it is better in prayer to have a heart without words than words without heart.
So we don't agree with Gandhi.
No, we do.
No.
We need words.
Oh, you're okay. And I'm saying we need more of Gandhi.
You ever see Robin Williams and Gandhi, by the way? He has a great shtick in Gandhi.
Who?
Gandhi or Robin Williams? Which one did you hear? Robin Williams. Robin Williams has a shtick on Gandhi. He's like, you know, all these people we talk about, these righteous saints, I'm sure that there's some guy in India, among those millions of people, that's sitting there and saying, that Gandhi, he was a son of a... You know, I had a fight with him in a bar once. His whole shtick about, you know, making this whole saint, right? By the way, he was pretty abusive to his wife, Aga. Anyway, yeah. But Becholov and Gandhi. Becholov and...
By the way, just a nefesh.
Yeah.
Where did they go?
Exactly. If you don't have objectified, if it doesn't become objectified, it can't endure. Exactly. You could have a leader, but it doesn't become lamaisa.
So
Schleiermacher and Kierkegaard had, you believe, did have objectivity also.
100%. 100%.
That's where you disagree, because he's saying...
Yes, and I also don't think they brought to destructive consequences. I think they both contributed a tremendous amount to Protestant Christianity, and I think, but Schleiermacher is not as well known, but I think Kierkegaard brought a tremendous amount to all religious people. Even Catholics today read Kierkegaard. Well, some of them, except the really firm ones. Anyway, so let's go back into Lonely Men of Faith. However, oh, now one more thing I want to say before we go weiter. I know it's already getting a little late, but I have to say one more thing. So if I would ask you the answer to the why question, based on the Rav over here that he hints to, and in Halachic Man, according to the Rav, why must it be translated into objectivity? Why? What's the answer? Because otherwise it can't endure.
Disappear.
Can't endure. Hasidic philosophy would say something different. Well, not that it wouldn't agree with that, but Hasidus has a whole different explanation. And I just want to say it over here because I think it's important to know. According to Chassidus, there's another reason that has to be transformed into objective. And it's a very deep idea because according to the Rav, it comes out that sof kol sof, the objectification of religion is a bidyeved, which is sort of like what Jay said with the Rambam, right? Sof kol sof, according to the Rav, the necessity to objectify religion is a bidyeved because otherwise it can't endure. Right? So, but if, so to speak, theoretically, you know, whatever, but that's like you say, according to Chassidus, it's the opposite. According to Chassidic philosophy, especially in Chabad, there might be those that would say only in Chabad, but definitely in Chabad, and the Rav himself brings in Halachic Man, according to Chassidic philosophy, the objective gesture of the religion connects to the essence of God more than any subjective feeling ever can. According to Hasidic philosophy,
and the Rav wouldn't say that.
No, the Rav would. I said, in Halachic Man, he brings that also. Right. He does bring that from Tanya.
The Rav said that's the idea.
100%, and it comes. The Rav quotes it from the Alter Rebbe in Halachic Man. He quotes it from the Alter Rebbe. I can tell you where it is. It's right. It's on the page. It's on the page. Page 56. He mamash quotes the Alter Rebbe. The page before. I don't want to get into it, but he says. You want to see it in the Halachic Man? If we have it in front of us, look at page 55, the bottom of page 55. Last two lines in page 55. See it, the bottom two lines? Now, because the commandments were given to us by way of being clothed in the attribute of strength and by the contraction of the light, therefore, most commandments have a delimited contracted measure, right? What do we mean? Minutia. For instance, the length of the tzitzis has to be 12 times the width of the thumb. The phylacteries, the tefillin, has to be 2 fingers by 2 fingers. Right? The thing that people always laugh at Judaism. Why do people always laugh at Judaism? These seemingly ridiculous minutia. If the tefillin is not big enough for the tzitzis, The lulav has to be 4 handbreadths. The sukkah, 7. The shofar, 1 hammer. The mikvah, 40 saw. Similarly, the sacrifice of a duma contracted measure. Right, and similarly, the act of charity and the performance of deed, loving kindness, one's money, right? Even though it is one of the pillars upon which the world stands, it is written the world is built by chesed. Nevertheless, it has a fixed measure. One wishes to perform it has to give 1/5, right? For two lines down. For since the world is delimited and measured, the Torah's commandments of charity and deeds of loving kindness were also given a measure and standard, just like the other commandments. And where's this quote from? From the Likutei Torah. Now from Tanya, I think I'm pretty sure, Tanya, whatever. Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the friend of Chabad Hasidism, the great luminary of halacha and mysticism, sensed that the fundamental method of the halacha is that of the quantification, which is so integral a part of the mystery of Tzimtzum. Right? And that's the idea that exactly what the Alter Rebbe is saying, that Tzimtzum is, how do you bring the infinite light of God into the world? Only the lulav. Your mind can't grasp infinity. The mystery of Tzimtzum of Torah is that God gave Anochi, stands for Ana Nafshi Ksavas Yavas, I wrote and I gave myself. God gave himself in Torah Mitzvahs, the 240 Mitzvahs, the 240 limbs of the king. And that means that the words on the page of the Siddur have in them more of God's light than anything you could ever feel in your mind and heart. That's what Chassidus teaches. The words, those dry words in the Siddur, the piece of matzah, the lulav, God contracted his infinite light into these objective things. Because we, through our minds and hearts, through subjectivity, can never reach infinity. We can't. No matter how inspired you are, we're finite beings. But God wanted us to be able to reach His infinite essence, or Ein Sof Mamish, and therefore He gave Torah Mitzvahs, these objective laws. There you touch Ein Sof Mamish. That's what Chassidus is about, and that's why, ready for this, that's why Chassidism can never go off the derech and they didn't need the Vilna Gaon. Because Chassidus is telling you that halacha, what does the word halacha mean? Most means to walk. So most people translate it means the way that we're supposed to walk through life. But in Chassidus it says halacha means walking God into the world. Halacha, bringing God, walking God into the world. The reason that you didn't need the Vilna Gaon is because Chassidus says that halacha is teaching how to bring Ein Sof into the world. No subjective experience could do that. And so the emuna that Chassidus teaches is that the words on the page have more spiritual potency than anything you could ever feel or feel in your heart or mind. Not to say that you don't need this, that you don't need to have the kavana. You do, because
you see what you're saying in all in the early, like the normally now. Can you see that kind of message, or it's just in
not openly? Kavana? No, not openly.
It might be more Chabad as opposed to Chagas Nehem type of stuff. You know.
So here's the thing. So that brings to a whole general question whether the other Hasidic movements just didn't explain the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov as much as the Alter Rebbe, or they were saying something different. And academics spend, you know, years researching it, and it's not clear. Because you'll find statements in Maranaim and in Kedushas Levi, you'll find statements about like a halacha like this. I'll give you an example that you could use at your Passover Seder. In Kedushas Levi from the Berditchever, Ilu kirvanu lefnei har Sinai, did I mention this here not too long ago? So it was someplace else. If he would have brought us before Har Sinai and not given us the Torah, Dayenu. The heck does that mean? That would have been an exercise in futility. What would it mean to go in front of Har Sinai and not get the Torah?
Experience.
What do you mean the experience?
The revelation.
The experience of the revelation?
Without getting the Torah.
Okay. We could say Pashup Shat. I mean, the whole experience was the Matan Torah. I mean, what else was Matan Torah? Could be cool, you're saying, right? But anyway, but the Berditchever says like this. The Berditchever says that by Har Sinai, we reached the level of Puska Zumasa, and the Gemara and Shabbos says we lost all our impurity, and we reached the levels of like the Ovis and Adam Arishan. We experienced God. We experienced Mamash Hashem. We have Mamash, like we were speaking before about biblical Judaism, we were all like prophets. Well, like you would say, the experience, right? So why would that be Dain of Leinu Salat? Why is getting the Torah greater than being at that level? So the Berditchever says, because at Har Sinai we became like Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that had unbelievable spiritual experiences. But says the Berditchever, a blat Gemara, when he gave us the Torah, was Ein Sof Mamish. In the language of Chassidus, the Ovis were only in Atzilus. They only had spiritual levels of God light. A page of Baba Metzia, a pair of tefillin, is Ein Sof Atzmus Umhus, the essence of God. That's how the Berditchever says. That's Mamish like Chabad. It's in Kedushas Levi. So that's the Vard. That's the answer how Chassidus will explain. And the Rav brings it over here also. So it's the philosophical answer and the Chassidic. The Chassidic answer is the objectification of the law is the way to get to Ein Sof. That is how you get to Ein Sof. You can through your subjective experience. Which again doesn't mean you don't need Kavana. You need Kavana also. Because you do need to feel something as much as you can. You do need to have that awareness. But we have to have emunah, and that's the emunah that kept Jews for thousands of years, is that the Torah and mitzvahs, they themselves are the end, not just the means to an end. We have to know that the Torah and mitzvahs are not a means to an end, they are the end, because they have in them God Himself. Tough.
Could you share a little heshbon?
Yeah?
So, although I once said this over to a yeshiva guy, and he said, oh, you go with the show tomorrow, but I learned it in Heschel.
Yeah.
So, the question why sometimes we say Mizmor the David and other
generations. The David Mizmor. Right. Say, listen to this. It's a beauty. You know this Vark? Like, listen. It's a great Vark. Say it again.
I don't know, but I saw it in Heschel, right? So sometimes the Hillel starts Mizmor the David and other David Mizmor. So, why? So, over the years, I might have kind of went someplace else with this, but my understanding is that sometimes you picture kind of David, a melech, and you know he was tired in the morning, wasn't in the spiritual mood. So, but he started with his mizmor le David, and through the mizmor, through the words, it transformed him and you know created the spiritual experience for him. Sometimes he was very inspired, David as well. Through the experience of David, he, you know, was able to express that spirituality through the Mizmor. Is that how you would?
Yeah, 100%. You had the Mizmor. The Shaila is which is causing which. Sometimes you have the subjective that leads you to open the Siddur, and sometimes the Siddur itself is there, and that could bring you to that subjective experience. 100%.
So is that a Gemara or just Heschel?
I didn't see it. I know the idea. I don't know if it's just Heschel,
well,
but I don't think
it's... You never saw that before? That's not Heschel.